You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was late September 2015 when the lid blew off the Flint water disaster. At the time, much of the attention, much of the credit, went to Virginia Tech water scientist Mark Edwards and Flint pediatrician Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. Edwards had been issuing a steady flood of warnings based on his test of water from Flint homes. And Dr. Mona's study of blood lead levels in Flint's children finally convinced state officials a public health catastrophe had indeed occurred. But there is another player in all of this, and his analysis of Dr. Mona's medical study destroyed the state's contention that Flint's water problem was being overblown. Rick Sadler, Flint native and Michigan State University urban geographer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mona called you, Rick, in September 2015, where she'd been getting a lot of pushback from the state because its findings didn't support hers. What did she ask you to do?
Yeah, I had met Dr. Mona a few months before. We were doing some work on the pediatric clinic that we have here in town. And she called me up and said, hey, I have this flood lead data, and I need you to map it using your GIS analysis, so your geographic information systems work. And so I'm a geographer. I was trained in GIS at U of M Flint. And the long and short of it was she just wanted me to throw them on a map because she had only been able to look at the zip codes, not having that capacity to geocode them. And the problem is that our Flint zip codes don't match up at all with the city of Flint. And so when you're looking at a Flint zip code, you're including a bunch of people from all the townships and one of the cities that are outside of the city limits of Flint.
And that's what the state had been doing.
Yep, and so just making the assumption that, oh, if it says Flint 48507, it must be City of Flint, and so these are the kids we're dealing with. But the problem is that a third of that list actually includes kids who are outside the city limits and thus the water system of Flint.
Rick, as you put your analysis together, you did this spatial analysis.
Yep.
What were you thinking when you, put these maps together and realized, oh, wow?
Yeah, so I was trying to approach it purely as a scientific perspective and not put in any kind of passion, stay dispassionate to the issue and try and make sure that I got the science right without jumping to conclusions. But the outcome in Flint was so blatantly different from the outcome outside of the city. It didn't take me a lot of time to come over to the side that, yeah, there really is a problem. This really does validate what the residents of Flint and Mark Edwards' team and Mona had been saying for a long time.
You say that the state went wrong relying on zip codes for its analysis. And in your piece on theconversation.com, you call zip codes the bane of my existence as a geographer. Why is that, Rick?
Yeah, well, so I grew up in a city that had formed kind of after some of these zip codes were laid out. And so we had this little part of my city that was assigned a zip code to a neighboring city. So I had friends growing up who would kind of, say, oh, I live in such and such. And I'd say, well, but do you actually live in the city with me? We live in the same city. So it was just kind of frustrating, even as an adolescent, trying to show people this issue with different types of geographies and them not really being able to understand it because, they write on their mail, oh, I live in this city. Then becoming a professional within geography, we run into these types of issues all the time. And there's a name for it. It's called the modifiable aerial unit problem. And it's basically just the idea that if you cut a unit or an area up into different shapes of units, you're going to come up with different results. So if you're looking at access to healthy foods or crime rates or really, blood lead levels, you're going to come up with a different figure if you're looking at large areas or weirdly shaped areas or non-contiguous areas.
Well, does this really go back to when white settlers came into the indigenous areas and started carving up Michigan into their own arbitrary lines of townships and counties? Do we go back that far?
I don't think townships are quite as bad just because they are at least typically they're kind of square-shaped. They contain one coterminous area. I mean, I would say it goes back to maybe the 30s or 40s when the post office started assigning these postal routes. They were assigned based on what a postal carrier could do. And when our cities were cities and our country was country, you might do a segment of a city and kind of run out and do the 20 houses down the road and then come back and then that's your route for the day. And so the zip codes kind of grew out of those swaths. They're kind of like pie-shaped wedges of, in Flint anyways, pie-shaped wedges of the city. So it includes urban, suburban, and rural areas.
So in essence, just so because a lot of us are a little less scientifically and statistically bent, what the state got, let me see if I get this right, by using the zip codes was this watered-down analysis that was full of people who were not drinking Flint water.
For sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. And any one zip code includes a whole cross-section of people who live in, you know, older urban neighborhoods and newer suburban areas and rural areas. And so you're lumping people who are very different from one another socioeconomically and in terms of their exposure to environmental pollution into the same unit.
Is this common across the country, that a mistake like this that public health experts are making, or environmental experts?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's kind of a gap between, and it's growing, it's kind of rebuilding itself, but there was a gap between the urban planning and geographical professions and the public health profession. And the advent of GIS, or geographic information systems, into urban planning and geography in the last 20 years has increased the tools at their disposal for analysis. But because there hasn't been good conversation between them and public health, it means that when public health moves into geographical type inquiries, they'll often rely on more simplistic conceptions of geography, like zip codes or counties or something that doesn't have the same level of resolution.
And you touched on this, but take us in a little bit deeper, that these fragmented urban regions based on zip codes, how are they masking public health disparities for poor and minority residents really everywhere?
You know, if you are looking at the zip code level and the zip code includes people who are of higher socioeconomic status lumped in with people of lower socioeconomic status, you might wind up with a health statistic like, oh, the life expectancy is so many years. But if you really look at just the urban part of that zip code or the poorer part of that zip code, you might find that health disparities there are a lot greater. And so if we look across an urban region and we look at that, you know, kind of the zip code predicts your life expectancy kind of idea, there might be a variation between, you know, 70 years and 85 years. But if you cut it up into neighborhood units or some kind of smaller, more meaningful unit, you might actually find that life expectancy could vary between, you know, 60 and 85 years within an urban region because of the exacerbation of disparities within certain areas within those zip codes.
Well, then, Rick, what do you think, as an urban geographer, what needs to happen for public health and environmental officials, whether we're talking federal, state, or local, to not make this zip code mistake?
I think it's just being cognizant of limitations. So as geographers, we are naturally collaborative and we work across many disciplinary lines because we need that expertise in other areas. And so vice versa, it's kind of a recognition that there are some things that are geographical in nature and require somebody with that kind of training and urban planning background to think about what are the built environmental and social variables that might impact that. And there are other tools at our disposal. You know, we even just census units, like census block groups, are a lot smaller, and they're more homogeneous in terms of their characteristics within their areas.
Do you and Dr. Mona ever stop and talk about just what might have happened if she had not brought you into this process? I mean, how much longer it might have taken the state to admit that she was right and they did have an all-out disaster on their hands?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, there was so much activism in the community that the work of Mark and Mona helped tip the scale. But I think that I hope that wouldn't have been a whole lot longer based on the activism going on. Something would have happened. But yeah, it is, I mean, it's something that we think about. And we're working on a paper right now that's looking at some of the relationships between certain events in time and changes in blood lead levels in kids. And so one of the things we're doing is to build a counterfactual and see what would have been the added burden in terms of exposure to lead in the water if, for instance, you know, some of the earlier events hadn't happened, some of the local media reporting, or if Mark and Mona hadn't come around, or, you know, if it had taken another 6 months for it to blow the lid off. Those are some of the things that we're going to be looking at in a couple upcoming papers.
Well, we'll have to talk with you when those come out then. We'll very much look forward to that.
For sure.
Michigan State University urban geographer and Flint native Rick Sadler. You'll find his piece, How Zip Codes Nearly Masked the Lead Problem in Flint, at theconversation.com. Rick, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.